Just say again what it is. Today we're doing blah, blah, blah. And it's
yes, okay. By means of very brief introduction, we're recording. Today we're going to do Parshat Bamidbar, and we're going to understand the framework of Parshat Bamidbar. And again, if we have time, assuming we should have time, we're going to get a chance. Today is Yom Yerushalayim. We will study the poem written by Naomi Shemer, understanding the timeline of it, and understanding the references that she makes throughout the text. So now that we have the introduction, and thank you, Sima, as always, we're going to share my screen, and we're going to jump to, we're going to jump to the text, and we're going to open up with the text to begin, we have to dive in first. So we're diving into chapter 1 of the book of Bamidbar, following. Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe, and Moshe spoke to, God spoke to Moshe, but Midbar Sinai, in the desert of Sinai, in the Sinai desert, but Ba'ol Moed, in the meeting tent, the tent of meeting, Be'achad l'chodesh hasheni b'shana, on the first day of the second month, Shana hasheni, the Tetum Eretz Yisrael, on the first day, on the second month, of the Exodus and land of Egypt, and it's Lamar saying the following. What did he say? He tells you, I want you to count the Jewish people. So it's Rosh Hashanah in Israel. I want you to count the Jewish people. So the first question I want to understand is, where and when is this happening? Where and when is this happening? So the answer of when is very obvious because it tells us. What does it say?
Sinai.
Well, that's where.
First day.
No.
Day the of the second
first
month.
Day of the second month.
Right. So we are on Rosh of
the first day of the second month
in the second year. So the Jewish people left Egypt on Rosh Chodesh, on the 15th day of Nisan, right?
Uh-huh.
Now, a year later, and 2 weeks later. So a year and 2 weeks later, right around this time, by the way, a few weeks, we're already, tomorrow is Rosh Chodesh Sivan, so it's a month early, a month ago on the calendar. This is when it's happening, right? So obviously, that's the worst. We're a little over a year after since the Jewish people left Egypt. Where is this happening? So Judy, where is this happening?
Har Sinai.
I mean Har Sinai. How many Mount Sinai?
Right.
I mean Mount Sinai.
Rabbi, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it ER?
In the tenth.
Isn't it the first?
Right.
Isn't it the first day of ER?
It's the first day of the month of ER. We are in the second to last day of the month of ER. Right. So it's right around this time, 4 weeks earlier, the first day of the month of ER. But right a year, just a year, a little over a year after they left Egypt, right? A year and 2 weeks after they left Egypt. Now, but it's taking place, it's the Midbar Sinai and the Sinai. Does it really take place in the Sinai? I mean, right in front of Har Sinai. How long have they been? When did they go to Har Sinai?
Right.
When did they go to Har Sinai?
40 days after
the Jewish people leave Egypt, right? And then they counted the Omer, right? What day of the Omer? On the 43rd day of the Omer, right? How long did it take before they got to Mount Sinai? Got to Mount Sinai on the 50th day of the Omer, which is the 6th of Sivan. Sivan. That is, according to my calculation, about 11 and a half months before this. Why is this text here? If they were in Sinai 11 and a half months ago, why is it telling us that they're still in Sinai? Understand the question, right? And that's pretty radical. That's pretty interesting. If I'm jumping on this, is that we look at the text and we talk about, normally we've seen, in fact, we've seen this several times. Vayedaber Hashem Moshe b'Midbar Sinai lemor. You take this whole part out, right? Happens to tell us where what the date is, that's maybe that's relevant. But what's extra here and different than we've seen in any other time that's mentioned, Parshat Bahar, Parshat Vayakel, Kedoshim, etc., it's telling us what? It happened Be'ol Moed. B'Midbar Sinai, Be'ol Moed. What is the Ol Moed? The Ol Moed was the tent that was outside the camp that Moshe would go at and hear and speak to God. Right? So, why is the change here? And what I'm going to explain for a moment in the bigger framework here, much of this teaching comes from a wonderful talk that I heard Rabbi Nachum Taliptak, who's a fantastic Tanakh teacher. What I'm explaining is here is that this is a a transitional point in the history of the Jewish people, in the story of the Torah. And we're going to explain why, and we'll explain where we are. So first thing we need to understand is, as we go through, let's take a step back for a second, okay? Just to know, what does the story talk about? The story in parts of Amidbar talks about the counting of the Jewish people and the setting up of how they were encamped. That's what it talks about. That's pretty much the entire thing. Very long parsha, and it's huge, right? It's huge, but that's basically the two things: counting of the Jewish people, the counting of the Levium, and though where everybody was placed and where they were camped. That's what it discusses. I'm going to ask a third question. So far, we have two questions. First question is why is it in? Why are they still in Mount Sinai? Why is this in the Ohel Moed? What is the connection? And the third question, for those keeping on track at home, and don't worry, because thanks to Simba, we're recording. The third question is, yay, Simba. The third question is why are we counting?
Yeah.
Right, why are we counting?
Why are we counting? Wait a second. How many times are the Jewish people counted in the desert? So the answer is, they are counted here. They are counted two other times. One of them we know because it's because actually in Parsha we read it from Parsha Shkalim, right? Parsha Shkalim is when the Jews counted and they give the half a shekel. When does that take place?
In Parsha, they're giving the half a shekel before they were going to build the base.
They built the Mishkan, exactly. So there, but they were counted. Now that used that to build the Mishkan, but they were counted. So we have one story where they're counted in Parsha Kitisa. And then we have the other time that they're counted, which is here. And then we have a third time that they're counted, which is in Parshat Pinchas, they're counted again, right? Mm-hmm. Now, here's my question. I understand why we count in Parshat, for really 100% why it's necessary to count, because if God knows everything, he'll just tell us how many people there are, right? And they'll say, hey, Moshe will say, hey, how many people we are? And you need it, by the way, for I know. How many people live in the? That's why they took the census. Did they ever finish the census? I know I took the census because you need to know how. 2020 census. I filled it out. Anybody should fill it. You haven't done it. You're supposed to fill it out by on the internet. You have to know how many resources, how many people in each tribe, how much plumbing they need, how much garbage pickup they need. You know how much all these things. How many parks they should have. Etc. Right, so things know this. So we did it in but God would have told them. The answer the rabbis always give is because you get counted. The counting is not for the person. It's for the people. You want to show that every person counts. It's very nice. Rashi even says that how chaviv, how special each and every person is. When you love something, you count it. If you love money, you count your money. If you love my son is obsessed with Pokemon cards. When I say obsessed, I mean it's a little unhealthy, right? And he sits there and he counts his cards and he organizes cards and he shows this and ever so to show, and this is a beautiful idea in the Dvar Torah, to show that each and every person is special, he counts them. That's a very nice idea. But practically speaking, why is it being counted? They're counted because the government is supposed to run a certain way. So after they leave Egypt and Parshat Kitzisa, they receive the Torah, they're counted. And Parshat Pinchas, they're about to enter the land, right? So they're counted because you want to count them to prepare to enter the land to give out their nachalah. Why are they counted here? What is the purpose of being counted here? This count in the beginning part of Amidbar seems irrelevant. It seems completely unnecessary. In fact, if we're just saying that this is the first month, the first day on the second month of the second year. So how far away is that from Parshat Kitisa when they counted the first time? Meaning when they counted Parshat Pinchas, how many years is it? It's 38 and a half more years, right? The numbers are going to have changed. But if you're counting here, well, it's just 6 months ago, 8 months ago, 6 months ago. What do you need to count for? We already counted. There's no purpose in counting at this point because we just counted a few months earlier.
What happened right before this? I'm just curious.
So that's a very good question. I'm going to answer that question in just a moment. Well, I'll explain actually, Judy, is that it's really the question of answers two of our questions so far on here. which our question is the first two questions. Why are they in the desert? Why are they in Sinai, right? And why are they still in Sinai? And the answer when you asked what happened before this point, well, let's do a little timeline. They leave Egypt, right, on the 15th day of Nisan. They travel, count 50 days, they receive the Torah. After they receive the Torah, what should happen? What should happen after they receive the Torah?
They should go into Israel.
They should be done. Thank you very much. We don't have a map here, but if I showed you a map, and of course today is the Yom Yerushalayim, so it's the anniversary of the Six-Day War. They conquered the Sinai. You know, the Sinai, it's not that big, right? I always tell people, when you want to understand the map of Israel, right? So everybody talks about how Gaza is occupied, right? Gaza is fenced off because its border is Israel, and Israel has closed the border. It's occupied, right? But Steve Goldshine, who's just joining us now, Steve Goldshine will tell us that Gaza has two borders. One of them is Israel. Where else is it border, Steve? Where is it?
Yeah.
I put you on the spot, Steve. The second border, I can't. Peter, I have to unmute yourself. I don't hear you. The second border is Egypt. Egypt is the second border. So basically, when they say that Israel has a closed border, they're not letting anything in, of course, that's a fallacy. That's true, but it's a fallacy because there's a second border, and Egypt has closed them off also, right? Except for the tunnels. The tunnels that allow them to smuggle things and to build bombs. So what you have, so if you wanted to go from Egypt to Israel, you go through Gaza. You go through Gaza, and it's really, you go through the Sinai, you go through Gaza. It's not very big. It's pretty easy to go to. In the timeline as we started, what should have happened is they left Israel, they left Egypt, they received the Torah, they had to prepare to receive the Torah, they took a little while, they received the Torah. The next day, what should happen? The next day, at least according to Rashi, the next day they should enter the land of Israel. What happens? Why does that plan go wrong? Because what happens at Mount Sinai?
Chet ha'egel,
the sin of the golden calf. Now, according to the Ramban, this was the original plan to begin with. But according to Rashi and many others, the building of the Mishkan is only a response to the sin of the golden calf. And therefore, now you can't go to Israel right away. There's a different model. It's not actually, you'll see that it's an angel that's leading them. And it's a completely different. If you look at Parshat Mishpatim, it's described differently on how the agreement of the covenant is different, which for a different time we'll share. But so they're not going to go the same way, and they have to build a Mishkan. How long does it take to build a Mishkan?
Well, we had 9 months.
It took a long time because like 9 months. When do they dedicate the Mishkan? They dedicate the Mishkan on the first day of Nisan. Right. Following year, almost a whole year from the time they left, minus 2 weeks, that's when they dedicate the Mishkan, right? So now it's Rosh Chodesh Nisan. When should they enter the land of Israel? The next day, right? The next day. Well, what happened?
40 years.
What?
Another 39 years.
Well, no, we're not even up to that. We're far from up to that. Why didn't they enter the land of Israel right after the next day? You should have a party, right? You should have a big celebration, which they did. Sadly, Nadav and Avihu died, but the party went on, right? So then, the next day, you should enter the land of Israel, right? What's the problem? The hangover, right? You had too much partying. The problem is that God said that the Nesi'im will come. We're going to read about them next week. But the Nesi'im will come, and they will want to bring their sacrifices and their gifts. And so they said everybody should have their own day. So instead of celebrating on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and the second day of Nisan they get into the land, what they did is that every day for 12 days they all brought different celebrations from each tribe. Okay? We're now on the 13th day of Nisan. What happens on the 13th day of Nisan? Well, on the 14th day of Nisan at least, what does that mean? We have Erev Pesach. Erev Pesach is you bring your Karban Pesach. Busy day, big holiday, whatever. They bring the Karban Pesach. They celebrate Pesach, right? We're now 7 days later, it's the 22nd or the 23rd day of Nisan. And what should happen? Now the next, they should walk, go into the land of Israel. It shouldn't take more than a couple of days to get into the land of Israel. What happens is that people start, there's an issue. What's the issue? Is there's a group of people who did not, we'll learn next week's Parsha, Parsha in 2 weeks, Parsha Balotcha. There's a group of people who did not get a chance to bring the Karban Pesach. And they said, you know, it's not fair. Maybe we could do it as well. And what they were hoping is that Moshe would say, sure, no problem. I know you're Tamei, you're not Tahor, but don't worry about it. You could do it, right? But of course, Moshe doesn't say that. He first says, let me ask God. And God says, you need to become Tahor. You need to be purified. And we need to follow a month. We'll let the month wait, and we'll get to Rosh Chodesh Iyar. We'll get to Chodesh Iyar. The 14th day of Iyar. We're now a month later. Now on the 14th day of Iyar, right? This is already past what we have here, right? Somewhere, this is 2 weeks prior, 2 weeks after what we have here. Here we're in the first day of Rosh Chodesh Iyar. Here we're already in the 14th day. So somewhere along the way, some of this had happened. And then, of course, after that scene, you have the sending of the spies, which takes 40 days, and then you have everything loose. So basically, that was the downfall, and until chapter 10, everything until chapter 10. Chapter 11 is where, the bankruptcy chapter, but chapter 11 was where the people start complaining, and they want meat, and they don't want to travel so much, and then you have the Chet of Miriam, and then you have the spies that follow, etc., etc. That's when everything else comes downhill. But from until chapter 10, where this whole scene, that everything that we've just described takes place where? It takes place at Mount Sinai. The entire time, the whole, from the moment they got to the Mount Sinai, which is in the middle of Parshat Yitro, chapter 19 in Parshat Yitro, Vayichen Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar, the Jewish people camped next to the mountain, the Rashi tells us, Ishechad Balevichad, like one people, like one heart, a beautiful thing, a beautiful whatever, and they don't leave there. We have this perception. They say, oh, well, the Mishkan was probably built. They were wandering around. It was all on the right. No. The Mishkan was built right at Midbar Sinai, right at the foot of the mountain. All of this, they were there for over a year. Everything had nothing. They haven't moved one inch since the mountain. Since the giving of the Torah, they have not moved one inch. In fact, so that's why until this point, when we see, when we see that it's mentioned very times, Vayishdaber Hashem Moshe b'Midbar Sinai Limor, it's because on all of Parshat Sefer Vayikra, they were still on Mount Sinai. In all the book of the end of Parshat Sefer Shemot, they were still on Mount Sinai. And for the first 10 chapters of the book of Bamidbar, they are at Mount Sinai. They haven't moved one inch. All this is taking place at the same time, at the same place. The difference we have here is that it's referring to Ba'ol Moed. Until that time, it says, but God spoke to Moshe, B'Midbar Sinai, just plain. Now it says, B'Midbar Sinai, Ba'ol Moed, in the Tent of Meetings, where God would manifest his speech to humans in this world. And so what you now see is the transfer of the Sinai experience is now being transferred into the Ol Moed. God's revelation until that point was only at Mount Sinai, and now God is speaking in the Ol Moed, which means that they're moving away from Sinai. They're taking the Sinai experience, and they're moving it with them through the Ol Moed. And that's where God would reveal himself. God, Moshe, would go into the Ol Moed, the Tent of Meetings, and hear, and God would speak. And he would hear what God was saying, and then he would convey it to the Jewish people, right? Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lamer, but Ol Moed, right? From here on in, we mentioned Midbar Sinai because they're not in Midbar Sinai beginning in chapter 10. They're now wherever they are in the many places they travel. And every time we hear God speaking, it is specifically in the Ol Moed. It's almost this transfer of from Sinai to now God will go travel with them. This is a tremendously transitional portion book, and even more so, I want to explain why this is referred to as the Book of Numbers, and why there are two numbers. And as for those who came late, why there's numbers, why there is counting right here when it seems to be they just counted 6 months ago in the same location and nothing's changed. It's not like there's been. The first thing Judy said to me was, what happened beforehand? The answer is not a heck of a lot. Nothing's been going on beforehand. They've just been sitting there waiting for the time to come where the whistle will blow, where the trumpet horn would actually blow, and they would say, okay, forward march. And that doesn't happen until the middle of Parshat Balotcha, And then things change dramatically. Now, before we continue, I want to sort of understand the role of all the different books. The role of all the different books, and by doing that now, we'll have a better understanding of the role of Book of Bamidbar. Okay? So if you had to describe, right, if you have a role of, basically, the Torah opens up and says, asks a question. Rashi asks, the first Rashi in the Torah asks an excellent question. It says, why do we begin with Bereshit Bara Elokim? I know I'm going back many weeks, right? Parsha Torah opens up, Bereshit Bara Elokim et Hashamayim v'Haaretz. Why do we begin with the story of creation? Why don't we begin with the mitzvah of Chodesh HaZelechem, which was the mitzvah of giving of the calendar? In other words, Rashi is saying, why don't we begin with the commandments, with the mitzvot, rather than begin with the story of the creation? How many Jews were there at the story of creation? Zero. Why don't we start with the beginning of the Jewish people, the nation? If the Torah was given specifically to the Jewish people, why do we have this whole book and a half, or at least a book, of the story of other people, at least the first few portions, the story of other people? I understand you want to tell a little bit of the founding fathers. Why don't we just start with the story of the Exodus? Why do we need all of this, especially the story of Bereshit, the creation of the story of Noah? Basically, Rashi is asking is that what is the purpose of this Torah? Is it a book of stories or is it a book of laws? It's a really legitimate, very great question. Is the purpose of the story, is the role of the Torah, is it to tell the story of the Jewish people or is it to be a book of instructions on how we're supposed to behave? That's really the million-dollar question. I'm going to stop sharing my text. And that question's a huge question, and that is a great question to have if you have a 30,000-hour Shabbat coming up where it's going to be raining the whole time and you have people who are willing to talk to you, right? Already, that criteria is not going to be so easy, right? Ever. But assuming that you can say, is the Torah a history book or is it a book of laws? That's a question. And that the truth is that if you look at these books, of course, and if you look at the different books, you'll actually see that they take different roles. For example, the Book of Bereshit, is it a history book or is it a book of laws?
It's
a book of stories. It's a book of stories, right? The book of
But it takes you through the history.
It takes you through history, but it's a book of stories, right? The book of Shemot, is it a book of stories or a book of laws?
Laws.
So the book of story of Shemot is actually a stories. I mean, we have the story of the Exodus, we have the story of the giving of the Torah, and at the end, we have the commandment of building a Mishkan, which is really, for the most part, a story, which is how we complete the end of the story of the Mishkan. Right, so and it's laws on how to build the Mishkan, but it's really part of the story. And they built the Mishkan, and how they do this, they built it this way. It's really a book of story. Very few laws in the book of Shemot. The very few laws in the book of Shemot, and the laws that we have in the book of Shemot are really part of the story. Laws of Karban Pesach, the laws of setting a calendar, which is about freedom. All the laws, even the laws of Parshat Mishpatim, are the stories. Well, it has the laws are sort of relevant to the stories. We're about, you receive the Torah, what is the Torah about? And it gives us samples in the book of Mishpatim. The book of Vayikra, is it stories or is it laws?
Laws.
All laws. There is almost no stories in all the book of Vayikra. There's one in Parshat. Other than that, it's just a book of dry laws. Torah's Kohanim. Book of Devarim,
It's a recapitulation of what has happened.
So it's a recapitulation, and so that, which is the right answer, but it's not 100% the right answer, because the truth is that, and we refer to it as Mishnah Torah, but the truth is it's not, because there are a lot of differences. In fact, one of the classes that we didn't get to on the Aseret HaDibrot is the differences between the Ten Commandments given on Har Sinai, the Ten Commandments that Moshe tells over in Parshat Beit Hanan, and there are so many discrepancies throughout. Even if you look, Moshe repeats some of the stories in the book of Parshat Devarim and Beit Hanan, and Moshe tells over a bunch of stories of what happened. He changes the stories. Because really the purpose of those stories is Moshe's final speeches to the Jewish people who are about to enter the land. Rabbi Liebtag gave a great example. He said, imagine if you're at the Super Bowl, right? You have a team, your team is at the Super Bowl. And at halftime, the coach gives a speech. And what does the coach say at halftime, generally speaking?
Go get him,
right? That halavai, that's all he says. He'll tell you, you messed up here, and you messed up here, and we need to improve with this, and this went well, but it needs to be consistent, you need to whatever. It's not just go get him. It's, let me tell you all the things that happened that we didn't do well, and we have to do better, and have to be stronger, right? And of course, if you took a snapshot, if you had a video of that, and you didn't know the context, you would probably think that they were like one of the worst teams in the league, right? Because, you know, in fact, they're one of the best teams in the league, maybe the best. They're at the Super Bowl. But when you're listening to the story, basically the coach is saying, this was done poorly and this needs to be done better. This needs to be done better in order for us to win. And that's the same thing with Moshe. Moshe is saying, in order for, we did a bunch of things wrong. In order for things to be better, excuse me, you're going to need to improve on all of these things. And I'm going to highlight a whole bunch of them. And that's really the Book of Devarim. The Book of Devarim is really unique in that way, where it's Moshe, it's really just a book of speeches of Moshe to the Jewish people.
Rabbi.
Midbar. Yes, Arnie.
Isn't it possible, though, I mean, this is 40 years later, Devarim and Exodus. It's possible he forgot all of the details in that time. Maybe that's
not just possible. It's different people.
True, right.
It's completely different people. It's that entire generation is gone. The Book of Devarim is really 4 or 5 weeks of the end of Moshe's life.
It takes place over. So, but when he's explaining, though, he could have the Ten Commandments that were in the.
But Moshe didn't forget. Moshe didn't forget. I gave a class not too long ago about how showing the distortion, but when we get to. At some point, maybe we'll talk about how there are changes in the story that Moshe tells over, with the sin of the spies, with the story of Yitro. If you look at, you'll see Moshe tells the story differently, and that's because it's not that. Just to highlight, I remember Judy was in the class, if I recall. The purpose of telling that story is not for history, and we think it's about repeating the history. It's not. Historians in general, their purpose was not to tell over history stories. Their purpose was to inspire the people and to have, they had an agenda. Their agenda, if you look at the history books, ancient history books, they ask, why isn't the story of the Exodus in the Egyptian history books? Because they didn't want the story. Because that story makes them look bad. So instead, they tell the story that they just skip over it, right? And it would make perfect sense, because many times when there are failed battles or devastate or whatever it is, they don't mention it. It's not relevant. The purpose of history in those times was propaganda, which was, this is my agenda. I am great. I am the king. You should follow me, etc., etc. And that's how all history was. We're used to history being, not anymore because of fake news, but we're used to history being an accurate story about this happened, this happened, this happened, looking at the facts. In those times, that was not the purpose of history. It was not about facts. It was all about promoting an agenda. And Moshe's agenda was, don't mess up like those people did. Be good, follow God as you enter the land. And you'll see the discrepancy in that story. That's really, Moshe is following the style of time for history. But wait, Moshe is not telling a history story. He's
in the back on the top shelf. I'm sorry.
No worries. No worries. Okay, so back to our story here. When we get to the book of Bamidbar, right, we've divided Bereshit stories, Shemot stories, Vayikra laws, Devarim, a pep talk, a speech. What is Bamidbar? Is Bamidbar stories or is it laws? And the answer is it's both. We have a lot of stories, very cool stories, pretty more important stories, often very tragic stories. We also have a lot of laws spritz in. And understand that the book is relevant in that way, so because it is really a bridge between the two sections. It's halftime of the story of the Exodus of the Jewish people, right? So really you divide the book of Bamidbar into three parts. The first part we mentioned, and that is the Jewish people preparing to enter the land. And that's where we are right now. Up to chapter 11, until chapter 10, including chapter 10, you have the Jewish people staying in the same place, doing absolutely nothing, and waiting to be getting ready to go. And they're almost there. From chapter 11 until really Pinchas, the story of the Baal Peor, where they sin with the Baal Peor, you have basically the downfall of that generation. And then where they'll have the sin of the spies, you have the sin of Korach, you have the sin of the Baal Peor, you have all of these sins, you have the complainers, etc. You have all of the people who die out. And the last time that people die is actually in the book, in the story of the Exodus, in the book of the Torah, is actually other than Moshe. But the last time that people die is in that sin of the Baal Peor, sin where Pinchas steps up, the story of Balak. And then, so that section stops there. And then you have the beginning of the last section, which basically is a transference of power. You have Moshe speaking to Yoshua and giving over and choosing a new leader at the end of Parshat Pinchas. You have the people beginning to conquer the land of Midian. You have the division of spoils. You have all of the, everything is really setting up for the people, these people, to enter the land and leave the desert. Those are our three sections. Now, keep in mind that in section number one, the first 10 chapters, the plan was to enter the land the next day. The plan was about to go in. So why do we count here? We count because, says the Ramban, this is all part of the strategy. You're about to enter the land. You need to start counting in order to be able to enter the land, in order to know how are we going to march, how are we going to fight, how are we going to prepare for war. So all this is about to happen. We're now about to leave Mount Sinai, which we've been sitting on for the last year plus. We've built the Mishkan. We've taken care of everything we need to take care of. And tomorrow we leave. And within a few days, or a couple of months, we should be there. It really should be a few days. We should be there. We keep getting delayed. We get delayed. But within a few days, we all should be there. So the counting that takes place right now is the counting all part of plan A until chapter 11. And chapter 11 comes, everything falls apart until Pinchas, and then the story picks up again, and it really is, after the story of Pinchas, at the end of parts of Pinchas, it's really just only a few months from then that that generation, that nation will enter the land. So the reason why we're counting is we're counting to prepare for battle. Rabbi Liebtag offered to say we're counting because they needed to stall for time. He even said he had a very funny thing. He says, if you ever go to camp, they have something called mifkad in Hebrew, right? Or even in the army, that's called something called mifkad, where you have to do a count off, right? And they say, so why do you need to do a mifkad? Why do they have to do a mifkad every day? Is there a kid missing? We lost that kid, right? So they do a mifkad because they wanted the kids to do a mifkad. They need to stall, right? So you give them an exercise. Anybody who's ever dealt with kids in education, you're like, okay, let's count the marbles, right? Do we need to count the marbles? No, but we need to give them something to do because there's nothing going on at this time. You're kind of stalling for time until breakfast is ready. And that's, so you do a mifkad and you sing a song and you march a little bit and whatever in place, and or you do exercises, whatever it is. And that's I just realized I didn't change the text. Sorry. and that's what's going on now. But really, they're just kind of, they're kind of just stalling for time until they're ready. But when the sin of the spies comes, there is a 38-year break that basically takes place in one verse. Because everything they this somebody puts the fast forward button and just says okay, and now we're at the end, and that's a Parshat Pinchas. Basically, everything else of the 40 years wandering the desert, it is very little wandering, and most of the time it only takes place in about two or three portions, because until this point in chapter 10, it is nothing is happening. The peoples remain at the foot of Mount Sinai, ready to leave the next day, and that just keeps getting pushed off over there. So everybody understand any questions we have on this part? Makes sense? Important to know just the framework. Wow, okay. Oh, they haven't left. They're still at Mount Sinai, right? Because they're about to leave. Because that was the whole goal. The whole goal was never to travel from place to place. The goal was to go to Mount Sinai, receive the Torah, and then go to Israel. And they were just waiting, right? Now, why are their laws mixed up in it? So that's an interesting question. I think it's because it's really the bridge between the two portions. We have the story of it is the story of both the Exodus and the entering of the land. So in order to do that, they bridge and they include laws in it. There's a variety of explanations that haven't been sold on either one, but it's clear that this Bar Midbar is different than all of the other portions in the Torah, and it plays a central and pivotal role in the transition of the Jewish people from one generation, which was unsuccessful and failed, to the next generation at the end of Parshat Bar Midbar, which were the ones that were chosen to enter the land. Everybody with me? Good. Any questions before we jump to the second part of the class? Okay, I'm such a good teacher. All right, so we're gonna jump to one. We're gonna try to do this quickly, and if you have to leave, that's fine as well. Where is this? Here. We're gonna spend a few minutes understanding this beautiful song by Naomi Shemer, which was voted as the most popular song in Israel, and possibly, you know, in the history of the Jewish people, this song Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. As today is Yom Yerushalayim. If you haven't heard it yet, it's a beautiful song. And here we have, I wanted to highlight this poem by Naomi Shemer and understand it in a historical context. The poem was written when? 1967. What month? So most of the poem was written in May of 1967. In May of 1967, there were already the rumblings of war. General Nasser of Egypt was walking around, was making announcements that he was going to drive Israel into the sea. There was a tremendous trepidation, depression of that the country was about to be at war and potentially wiped out. If you recall, if you've read, they were already in the parks digging graves. They anticipated masses, hundreds of thousands of casualties after being attacked by the Egyptians and the other armies. And so in May of 1967, right after Yom HaTzimut, they decided in Jerusalem to have a song contest, right? Have a song contest to celebrate Jerusalem, because Jerusalem needed a little boost. In fact, at this contest, I believe it was Rabin, actually maybe it was Levi Eshkol also, but Rabin was the general of the army, the minister of defense, and he was called to back because already they had started attacking the Straits of Tehran already at that point. So this is already happening right there. They're on the brink of war, which was potentially to exterminate the entire nation, that this 19-year experiment was not going to work. Basically, it was over. It was a nice experiment. The joke was, and I'm told, people told me that this was the joke, is that what they said the last one out at Ben Gurion shut off the lights. So, you know, that it's not going to work. It's not working. And in fact, many people who were able to leave did leave. It was a mass exodus from anybody who was able to leave that they left because the war was coming. So here, just to highlight, in a few minutes, Avir Harim Tzolul Koyayin V'Reach Aronim. The mountain air is clear as wine, and the scent of pine is carried. Nisa Baruach Harabayim Im Kol Pa'amonim. on the breeze of twilight with the sounds of bells. Now, what is the kol pa'amonim, the sounds of bells? Where do we see a reference of the sounds of bells? Sounds of bells were a reference to the Kohen Gadol. When the Kohen Gadol would go down the mountain with his the Temple Mount, he had on the bottom of his robe, he had pa'amonim. And so it was a reference to the temple and the service of the Kohen Gadol. Here it continues. Uvatar de'emot ilan, and in the slumber of a tree, the Evan Shvuya, and the stone that was captured, Bachaloma, in her dream, the city, Ha'ir Asher Badad Yoshevet, Ubilibachoma, the city that sits solitary, and in its midst is a wall. Why did it say Ha'ir Asher Badad Yoshevet? Where is that phrase from?
Yov.
Not Eov, but Echa.
Echa, I meant, yes, Jeremiah.
Another depressing book.
Yes, Jeremiah, right, Jeremiah.
Right, that Jerusalem sits alone, that it's by itself. And again, the country at this point, or at least the city for the most part, is desolate. It's really desolate. It's a war zone, or it's about to be a war zone, and people are feeling the sense of isolation, and it's desolate. And then she gets into this, Yishalayim shel zahav v'shenachot shoshet v'sha'or alachol shirayach ha'ikim. Yishalayim is of gold, of copper, right, of gold and copper. Where do we have gold and copper or bronze? Where do it translate as bronze? Where do we have gold and copper? Where there was a reference to?
Beit HaMikdash.
The Beit HaMikdash. At one point it had the Yerushalayim of gold and copper, the one of glory, right here. Michelle Or, Jerusalem is referred to as the Or Shel Olam, the light unto the world. It was the center of the world. We gave a class the other day about King Solomon. It was, everybody came from all over the world to see the temple, to see the beauty of Jerusalem. It was glorious. It was amazing. And now it's empty. And the Yerushalayim shel zahav, by the way, that phrase is actually in the Gemara. It's called Yerushalayim de dahava, which is Jerusalem of gold. Is that at the time of the temple, or maybe the destruction of the temple, they said this about Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva went to his wife Rachel, who, after he married her, her father, who was Kalba Sabua, was very wealthy. And Rabbi Akiva, she married Rabbi Akiva, and her father disowned her. And so she said, and they were extremely poor. And he said, if I had money, someday I hope to have money, and I'll buy you a Yerushalayim de Dahava, a Jerusalem of gold. There was some sort of crown that the women would wear to commemorate Jerusalem, and that they would wear it on their heads as a sign. Only prestigious women who wear this as a sign that they remember Jerusalem always where they are. And so that's where that phrase is, Yerushalayim shel zahav. It comes from the Gemara. And here she ends, Halo l'chol shirayach ani kinyor. To all those who sang, and I don't like the translation, they hold on for all of your songs. L'chol shirayach, to all those that sang your songs, ani kinyor, I am a violin, a harp, etc. But Kinur, of course, is a reference to
David
HaMelech, right? And David HaMelech is a, thank you, Judy, is a symbol, no, thank you, the symbol of those who would, there were always people singing songs about Jerusalem. It was Rabbi Yehuda Levi would say, Tzion Hala Tishali. People would write songs. We have beautiful songs about Jerusalem for thousands of years. But for all of those who sang their songs, I am the last Kinur. I'm the last one. There's no one left to sing to you. If it wasn't for me, the place would have no song whatsoever. And she's like, I am the last poet to write a song about Jerusalem, because who knows what's going to happen tomorrow. So you think about how she's writing, it's unbelievable. Continuing, Echa, of course, that's an obvious reference to the Book of Lamentations. Echa yavshu barot hamayim, how the cisterns have dried up, right? In every city, the city that's wealthy and well and provides for its community, you have the cisterns are filled with water. But now everything is dried up. That means it's abandoned. The cisterns are, nobody's living there. Nobody can live there. Hikar ashuk reka, the marketplace is empty. Bein kaput poketet harabayit b'ir atika. And there is no one who frequents the Temple Mount in the old city. Nobody's going to the Mount. The temple is destroyed and nobody's living in Jerusalem. It's all completely abandoned. Right? Remember that no Jew has been in
Muslim
the city in 19 years. In 19 years since 48, what's going on? What's happening to our beloved city? They said you were able to look over a fence and be able to see a glimpse of the Temple Mount. What was going on? If you keep in mind, when they found when they got to the plaza, which wasn't the plaza, when they got to the wall, the Jordanians had built low-income housing all over the plaza, and they filled the synagogue with horse manure. They had horses. They basically desecrated everything. And so there is no one that frequents the temple. No one's there. We used to go there and pray. Everybody would come to Jerusalem. It was a time of celebration. It was a beautiful, three times a year. And now it's completely empty. And the caves of the mountains, that the winds are howling. That is a reference to chapter 19 of the book of Kings 1, about that Elio goes into the mountain, goes into the caves, and the winds are howling, and God is not in the wind, God is not in the things, God is in the kol demamad daka, that in the small thin voice. And no one descends to the Dead Sea by way of Jericho. And that was, Derech Yericho was the main highway. Nobody goes that way because there's no one going. That would be, you would go from Jerusalem, you go take the main highway down to the Yam HaMelech, and nobody's going there. Then you have Yerushal, again, the stanza. Then she continues, but as I come to sing to you today and to adorn crowns to you, the crowns, of course, there are always, when God, it tells us in the Midrash, when God gave the Torah, the Jewish people, he gave them the Keter Torah, the Keter Malchut, the crowns of the Torah and the crowns of the monarchy, right? So she, as I come to sing to you and to adorn crowns to you, I'm trying to praise you. And there we have again that reference, and then I am the youngest, and I am the smallest and the youngest of your children, and I'm the last poet. I'm the last one to sing these songs. And the idea of being the youngest and the smallest, that refers to King David. David and King Shaul were all the youngest and the smallest. They referred to them. And that word katonti, by the way, is a reference to Jacob. Jacob says, I am not worthy of the blessings that you've given me right before, in Parshat Vayishlach, right before he met Esav, right? But basically saying, I'm the last one. I'm the smallest of all of the poets that came before me. I'm the least talented, she's saying humbly, and I am the last one to sing because there's no one left after me. He Saraf, which is a great term for your name, scorches the lips like the kiss of a seraph, and that is a reference to Isaiah chapter 6. It tells us in Isaiah chapter 6 that when God said to prophesize, he asked an angel to take tongues, God told Isaiah to prophesize, and Isaiah said, my lips are impure, so in order to purify it, they took a seraph, an angel came and put a coal on Isaiah, on Yeshayahu's lips, and so now I am, but your name scorches like the lips like a kiss of a seraph. I'm trying to purify my lips so I can be able to be worthy to sing your song, right? But I'm looking for the angel to do that. And of course, then she says that phrase from Tehillim, Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim, right? If I forget the Odrulim, Asher Kula Zahav, which is of gold. Here you have these two, I think there was a third, no? Maybe there was a third. I thought there was a third. But either way, you have these two beautiful, it's a lamentation. It's a song of depression, of, oh my God, how did this happen? Where am I? I'm here to sing the song of Jerusalem, the famous Jerusalem of gold with all of its glory, and there's nothing left. And that was the song Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. If you hear the recordings, which you need to, it's like a requirement to hear the recordings that we have of when they liberated Jerusalem, you immediately hear the soldiers singing this song. And they sang this song because that was the most popular song on the radio. So everybody knew the song. Probably the exception is Shlomo Goren. Rabbi Goren really had no clue because it was a modern song. He didn't know any of these songs, right? He didn't know this song. All of a sudden they broke into Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. But they only sang the first two stanzas. They didn't sing the last one because it hadn't been written yet. After they captured it in such a short time, the 6 days of war and the 6 days of the miracles, so they ran to Naomi Shemer and they said, you need to write another stanza to show that we've returned. And she quickly wrote this, Chazarnu al boro tamayim l'shuk l'kikar, we returned to the cisterns and to the marketplace, Shofar karaba harabayit v'ir atika, and the ram's horn calls out on the Temple Mount in the old city, and that was Rabbi Goren's ram's horn, Rabbi Goren blew the shofar when you listen to it, and they said, "We are now returned in jubilation and hearing the ram's horn." Of course, the ram's horn that was there, the shofar was there, was also an announcement of Messianic times, which they believe there was. B'shazna hazot Yushalayim habnuya. That's what Rabbi Goren said. It shows even just the listen, just repeating it, thinking of those amazing, the amazing scene with Rabbi Goren and the soldiers crying at the Western Wall. And the cave in the mountain, thousands of shine. We will once again descend to the Dead Sea by the way of Jericho. We now have control of that road, and we can return. We can have this. The traffic will flow freely. And I just gave a very brief. There's a lot more to give over here. We're out of time, but understand the story behind this, that the poem was written as a lamentation, and then it changed over because of the miracle of the Six-Day War. Just a few weeks later, it changed over to a song of celebration. And so, it changed over to a song of celebration, and the reference of the shofar kara bahara by the shofar being blown on the Temple Mount.
So I hope Rabbi, did you hear, there was the show, there was a like a commemoration yesterday that's, it was sort of OU and Mizrahi.
Yeah, we sent out the YouTube video.
So, okay, because I watched part of it and I was crying because they had the song, they have the things about the Six-Day War, and someone was saying how he went, exactly where they went to get to the. I mean, it was just incredible. I thought.
Yeah, no, there are so many resources out there. It happens to be that 3 years ago when I went for the 50th anniversary, I was able to walk to get a tour of the path that the soldiers took from Lion's Gate all the way up to the Temple Mount. Which is just, the unique part of this is that we actually have footage. We have footage of this liberation, which you don't have that anywhere else. You have the actual footage, or at least much of it, of the liberation. And it's just phenomenal. It's really phenomenal. And there's so many resources out there. I posted, if you got the morning email, there's a whole bunch of news of the Mizrahi, the OU, they're all posting footage. And everybody's at home. Still a beautiful day, but it's raining. You can still do it on Sunday also, or next week. Watch it, experience it. And the most important thing, and I keep saying this, and I said this morning, Peter was there, and so Steve, I said, there are miracles that happen, it's the impetus is upon us to talk about the miracles, to celebrate the miracles. The worst thing we could do is ignore miracles that happen to the Jewish people in this incredible, incredible day. It's a sanctified, it's a holy time. And so the most important thing, go have a falafel. Go do something to show that you're recognizing the miracle, and that miracle doesn't just get swept away and ignored. Thank you so much. Wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi. Shabbat Shalom.
Appreciation of the parsha, which is very cool. 6:45 today. Join us. We have with the young girl Merrick. We're going to have a beautiful singing, Kabbalat Shabbat, a couple of Yerushalayim songs. We all get ready for the Brei Torah for myself and Rabbi Winston, and we'll all get ready for Shabbat together. Take care.
Sorry, I kept jumping in and out. I'm actually at work also. Sorry.
That's okay. I understand. Everybody's multitasking. So
thank you.
See you later. Take care, everybody.
Okay. Bye. Take care.